Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, our last evening together on this retreat. It's been very nice practicing with you. It's a nice way for me to come back to Wellington. Thank you, Ajahn, for being so hospitable. I've had a chance to speak with many of you, and sorry, it's only half an hour, and it feels like a dentist's office out there. But it's just very inspiring to see people taking responsibility for their own consciousness and their own lives and trying to use this teaching to become better people and more free and realize the beauty of consciousness, which is not limited by all kinds of selfish perceptions and ingrained habits. So, sātu to all of you for the good effort. As I was saying in Palmerston North, and I think I said it once here, what is a high five in Buddhism? Sādu, sādu, sādu. And you have to, sātu, sātu, sātu. I was in I was in Sarnath when I was in November at the Holy Sites in India, and I was in the temple in Sarnath, and I went in early to do some sitting and had my eyes closed, and I could hear a lot of people coming in, and then I just kept my eyes closed to sitting. And all of a sudden I heard this congregation going, sadhu, 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 sadhu. And they just did it for about 20 minutes. And it was a group of Sri Lankan pilgrims who were all dressed beautifully in white, and they were about 20 or 30 of them were making offerings to the shrine of flowers. And each time someone offered, sadhu, 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 sadhu. And that was a tremendously inspiring experience to see that kind of devotional quality that you find in Asia. I think we Westerners find it more difficult to access that because we're probably more coming from critical backgrounds rather than faith backgrounds. But it is a faith and devotion are really beautiful qualities if we can touch into them. They're heart qualities. They have the sense of wonder in them. I know in Canada, quite often the way people come to those qualities are through wilderness. It's just being in one of those wild rivers in Canada or the great forests or hearing the loon. The loon does that. So we as human beings have all manner of possibilities in the human heart. And the Buddha was encouraging certain qualities as being foundations for happiness and well-being and liberation, enlightenment. And devotion is an interesting quality that I was very fortunate to have two teachers who were unspeakably profound in my life. So this, most of you know this is Ajahn Chah, and that's a pastel portrait which was done in London between 1977 and 78 by our prototype Anagarika, Jerry Rowlands. And it's full size, the original is full size pastel. It took him 2 years to do it. He took 10 pictures of Ajahn Chah. He had a still single lens reflex camera and just 10 times. And then he worked from that to get that. And then he showed me, it was interesting, I'm not an artist, so he just showed me one side of the face, showed me the other side of his face. He showed Ajahn Chah's mouth as it lost its sort of personality over the 10 shots. It just went. So he worked on that for 2 years. And he lived in the top floor of the Hampstead Vihara in London. And he was pretty obsessed with it, as any good artist probably is. And he was already in Hampstead. We arrived in Hampstead Vihara in 1977, and he was already there. So he took care of us, and he was a smoker. And we saw pretty soon he's never going to give up smoking. He was just too tense. So that was part of his practice out in the backyard, to smoke cigarettes, roll his own. And then Ajahn Chah came. It was interesting how Ajahn Chah related to him, because Jerry's a very tense, really tense kind of guy. And Ajahn Chah had this guy, I think he just loved eccentrics, and most of us Westerners are eccentric to him. And so Ajahn Chah used to smoke as a young man. And so one day, you have to kind of understand Thai culture. Like in Thailand, if a monk is sitting on a chair, on a bench, a layperson would never sit on the bench with him. A layperson would always take a junior position, never dream of sitting on the same bench as a kind of exalted teacher like this. So you kind of, you have to understand the Thai etiquette, Asian etiquette to get the full story. But anyway, one day I go out into the back garden, and there's Jerry and Ajahn Chah sitting on a bench. They're both smoking. It was really nice. Because you could see how kind he was, how compassionate he, and Jerry just looked so relaxed. And all of us just said, Jerry, you're going to get lung cancer, That was just so sweet. So Jerry was rolling up for Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah's a very elegant smoker. A beautiful example of a teaching which was unconventional and touched Jerry deeply. So that would have been 77. So then Jerry then worked on this painting, and we hardly ever saw him after that. And then Ajahn Chah was about to arrive. And so Jerry finally cleaned his room after 2 years, and he had framed the picture and left it up there, up on the third floor. And then Ajahn Chah came, and we had just been raving about this picture, because it was just such a lovely piece of work. And remember, he had never done portraiture. He had been into glass. He was an artist when he went to art school. Never done a portrait. So, now we're curious how Ajahn Chah is going to look at this. What's he going to say? So we had looked at it, and Jerry was there. So Ajahn Chah came, and we invited him up, and we're watching, and he goes in front of the portrait. He looks at the portrait, not a comment, and he picks up a piece of charcoal, and he turns to Jerry and says, "Would you be upset if I did that?" And just put it down, didn't say anything, didn't praise him, and just walked out. Actually, we took a picture. We've got a beautiful photo of him smiling beside that photo. But it was like classic Ajahn Chah, and Jerry loved it. Jerry kind of loved that kind of attention, we all did. And it was always good humor, compassion, but always like, are you attached? Can you take this? What will happen? It's a very heartwarming picture. So talking about devotion, this is what devotion is. You have some imagery or some way of plugging into that whole mindset of gratitude and awe, I suppose. What is devotion? just thinking aloud, maybe gratitude, awe. So when I look at that photo, I'm reminded of a great being. I'm reminded of a whole lineage of great beings, right back to the Buddha. And what can one do but bow? What else can you do but bow? What can you say? So bowing comes very, very naturally to the devotional heart. You know? It's not something which is imposed, and it's not really intellectual. It's more something from the heart. Then that photo is Ajahn Sumedho, as most of you know, and that was taken by John Johns, around 1990 probably, here. And John Johns died in 1999, and Bobby and John came up here. And John Johns was a photographer for the National Forestry Service, and he liked the work of Ansel Adams, the famous American nature photographer, and he worked in black and white, and so he took that photo. So this Ajahn Sumedho has been incredibly formative in my practice, very helpful, very kind, very compassionate. So when I see that, how lucky I am, and thank you. And what can I do but bow? What do you do? Bow. And you know, I'm impressed, very impressed by his practice, his dedication, and he's been so generous to me. And he's worked so hard. Now he's retired in Thailand, but you know, you come to that sense of gratitude, awe, and then you bow. And you can see how that as a type of consciousness is very beautiful and actually probably very, very helpful for the meditative practice. Because when the heart enters into that kind of softness of gratitude and humility of awe, then the kind of, I think the striving, the kind of thinking that I'm the author of my own enlightenment, that kind of grasping and hardcore, hard edge of meditation, and it falls away. You can't impose it, but what would be the way to stimulate devotion? I think for me, very much pictures that I have. You wouldn't believe my shrine. I just got photos all over. I got my first teacher. I got my mom. I got Ajahn Chah. I've got Jean Klein. I've got Sargadatta. I got a whole range of wonderful beings who have helped me. And then I use that. I look at those photos, and then I use the imagery, the iconography of Buddhism, Buddha images. So I've got a range of Buddha images, and so my little hut is festooned with these things. And it's lovely. It's just lovely just to go in and look and remember and come to a sense of gratitude and devotion. And then bow. And just bow. These are simple things. These are simple things, but they're very, very profound, I think. The critical mind is obviously necessary, but the problem with the critical mind is that if it's, I think in Visuddhimagga, the Venerable Buddha Gosa says, the critical mind, when it's attached to, it's like taking medicine and dying from the side effects. I mean, the critical mind can be so convincing, but then it can become very, very arrogant. And I found that in my own practice, my initial entry into Buddhism. I was living in India, and I was with a group of people who had a very intellectual approach, and they had some teachings from a Sri Lankan monk. Not an American, no, an Englishman who said he had attainments, and he lived in Sri Lanka, and it was so heady, to figure it out, kind of gave me a headache. But then when I figured it out, I got quite conceited. I thought I knew something, and I could see, no, that can't be it. That's just an opinion. So, to use the critical mind in a way which is reflective rather than opinionated, that's important. And then to use the devotional heart in a way which is uplifting rather than just blind belief. And this is the kind of combination perhaps we're looking for. So this is our last evening together, and so obviously we start to ponder our return to the world. And on that level, on what you do in family or work, I haven't got a clue. People ask me about kids, I don't know. I really don't. They ask me about, you don't call it marriage anymore, you call it partnership. Anyway, living with another person, I don't know. It's because my socializing skills have been developed in a fraternal way, in a community of men. So we get our social skills in different kinds of environments and become different kinds of people. But I think what is important in whatever social situation we have chosen to practice in, or that life has kind of chosen for us, I think some sense of self-sacrifice is very beautiful and a very important part of a kind of really truly spiritual path. Because, like I was saying earlier today, that one of the criticisms of Buddhism in the West is that it can just be a kind of feel-good thing, and the ideas of renunciation, self-sacrifice, giving up can sometimes be not emphasized. So what can be emphasized is I'm working on my stuff, and so on, which is important. But also that aspect of serving in community, self-sacrifice in family, which is the whole aspect of, I think, generosity and compassion. And generosity does have, you know, it's not just sharing my wealth with you, but it's also giving something up for you, you know, giving something, self-sacrifice. The way I know, like for myself, say Ajahn Chah asked me to go to England, and I did not want to go to England, I wanted to stay in Thailand. So it was interesting, when I got to England, I felt homesick for Thailand. When I was in Thailand, I never really felt homesick for England, well, or Canada. I kind of loved Thailand, I had my difficulties. So my teacher asks me to be somewhere, and then within that, I would rather be somewhere else. Now that's typical of life, isn't it? You're often in a place where, you know, you'd rather not be. But because my teacher asked me to do that, I said, okay, I trust you, I'll give that a go. And then within that, I've learned things which I don't think I would have learned if I had just gone my own way in Thailand. I've been pushed and challenged and prodded and beaten up and all manner of difficulties I've been through, but they've all been from a place of, okay, if this is what this situation has brought up, why can't I be mindful? And so one of my basic principles in understanding the Dhamma and my own heart is that every experience should deepen my capacity for awareness. Every emotion, every social situation, every experience should deepen my capacity for awareness. In other words, the really negative and difficult things I feel that I have that come up should be a way where I can strengthen awareness. And I think you can see the point of that. When something presses my buttons and I just get kind of, get kind of lost, I know, well, that's the area where I need to build parami. That's the situation where I need to somehow find strength. And so I found that repetition in daily life was very helpful. Repetition, a one-off where I just got confused by a person or a situation and it never happened again, I just kind of survived it. But if there is a situation where one person, one situation, one type of social context always brought up either aversion or fear or doubt or whatever, then it became quite a good focal point for understanding myself. And that's the way, you know, that's who I've tended to learn, is something overwhelms me and I get confused by someone or, and then I keep going back to that and back to that. So why can't you be mindful here? What is it? Why do I lose the plot here? Why does the self-view come up so strong? And that is what repetition can do. In conventional society, repetition is boring. You know, variety is the spice of life, right? So change and variety are kind of encouraged. And that, I mean, I like variety too. But when you notice like a retreat, it's not a variety show. Your mind might be a variety show, I don't know. But a retreat's just very ordinary. Just 5:30, bell goes, 6, sit. And we didn't sit every morning and negotiate what schedule we're going to have. Just do it. And you have a meal, and just every day the same thing. And so I think a lifestyle where a certain amount of regularity is inherent in it gives you a lot of space to observe the mind. If life is like just so varied and interesting, it can keep you busy and excited, but I don't think you're going to touch the stillness of the mind because the mind is going out all the time. So that, coming back to our kind of little paradigm of the Four Noble Truths we're using, the mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. The mind knowing the mind is the path, and the result of the mind knowing the mind is the cessation of suffering. We can twist the Four Noble Truths around. So you can see a lifestyle which is always, where consciousness is always being sent out into the internet or into even interesting things. You know, it becomes kind of addicted to always going out. Whereas kind of coming back home, then it's difficult when you come into a retreat because the mind's so used to doing that. But outside, it'll always be varied and interesting or boring. But back home, you can discover that stillness of consciousness. If I can just relate for you the time I cared for my mom and how I used that as a practice, that's kind of, I think, a good example. So I lived with my mom for those 8.5 years, and I was the kind of sole caregiver, and mom was 96 when she died. So she could move around on a walker, and her mind was very, very clear, and she was quite a happy person to be with. But it took quite a bit of work to do that. And so the situation was one where it was easy to feel love and openness, but just the kind of collection of tension, just like if you're always caring for someone, there's always, for me, you're always on guard, is she going to fall? And, you know, that kind of tension. So that when we work with things, we build up things in our consciousness. And so I found it was absolutely important to stay with my sitting practice, just absolutely important, every morning, every evening at least, and to really to be able to gauge what's happening in my life, what's happening in my daily life, what's the conscious experience doing to my mind. And that became, it's a kind of place where you both see how you're reacting to life, plus you have a chance to purify. And so, like, I had some old sibling stuff with my brother, and we're quite good friends, but I hadn't really lived with my brother since he went to college and I went to college, which was a long time ago, and I had only seen him on little visits. So naturally, some of the old sibling karma had to come up. It's just the way it is. You know, old buttons get pressed. It's a bit embarrassing to see this 13-year-old coming into consciousness. But there it was. And so it was quite interesting to kind of, this is that karma. Oh, I see. To kind of get a hold of it in a sitting practice. And then when I was with him, I could watch that arise. And it's just a struggle of not reacting through old big brother, small brother karma, just seeing that come up so strong. It was really interesting. And just using, okay, now I'm going to use this to deepen my awareness. I'm going to use this reactive part of me to deepen my awareness. So the very thing which seems to be a hassle, of course, becomes your ally. Your ally in becoming more profoundly still, more profoundly present, more profoundly open to the way things are. And that wasn't easy, but it had to be done, and so then I was grateful at the end of it. Just like exhaustion, say, just sometimes being so fed up, just utterly fed up, I just don't want to do this anymore. And then I'd feel guilty. And that would be the first, you know, just, and the exhaustion was natural, I was really tired. But then there'd be the guilt, I hope mom doesn't see this. Because, you know, moms can read their sons like nothing. And then there's a kind of fear, and a kind of reaction to the reaction. And then not understanding that, right? And then sitting, oh, this is the result of that. It feels like this. And then coming back into it every day, exhaustion, fed up, guilt, and then exhaustion, fed up, and then just exhaustion. You know, work it back. Oh, this is just exhaustion. Feels that way. And the desire to not have exhaustion, to have something else falls away. It's just that you can do a lot of things. But the process of understanding comes, I think, from that kind of situation of self-sacrifice, where you give up comfort, or it's asked of you to give it up, or what you'd like to do yourself. And I think you have children, married, have a vocation. We all have that. But to use it as a way to become more profoundly open-hearted, more profoundly still, is the way of self-sacrifice. Now, self-sacrifice as a duty doesn't work. Like if I try to take care of my mom as a duty, filial piety, I must do this. Then I resent it after a while, don't I? I must do this. You must do this. You know, in Buddhism they say, etc. And then I do it out of a sense of duty, but not mindfulness, not as a kind of practice to understand myself, not from compassion, just out of a sense of duty. Then within a week you feel resentful and put her in the old people's home. Right? It just doesn't work. So the understanding of self-sacrifice not as duty, but as a vehicle, you know, as a vehicle of practice. I think of my teachers. I think of Ajahn Chah. I mean, he just gives so much time. Just so much time to his community, Ajahn Sumedho, how much time he's given, the Buddha. And so those are good images to bring up, you know, kind of Gandhian images of service and self-sacrifice. Now there are limits. You know, self-sacrifice can also lead to burnout. And when there isn't enough mindfulness, or there isn't enough space, and there's just idealism, then that leads to burnout. And that's no good either. Burnout is not mindfulness. And when burnout takes place, then the psyche's ability to recover from that takes a long time. If you get burnt out, your nervous system takes a long time to reconstruct some kind of balance and strength. So I'm not advocating just blindly doing things, but to contemplate that how does burnout take place? Well, my experience of burnout, I've done that one too. Burnout takes place when I cannot be mindful. Not that I'm not trying to be mindful. It just takes place when I don't have, this situation is bigger than me, I don't have the capacity to be mindful. And then you have to say, well, okay, I've reached my limit. And when that comes, the signs, of course, are you just get... like you can't sleep, you cry easily, you get upset, get angry, you know, the whole emotional system is all out of balance. So that's not, then that's too much. And say, as a community, I know we always have to kind of look out for each other when people are that extended, when it becomes that extreme. And much of life isn't that extreme, you know. Much of life is just ho-hum and ordinary, just kind of ordinary things. And oftentimes in the ordinariness it's hard to be mindful. The mind just likes to drift into any old way. So structures are good. So like thinking on what you're going to do when you return to the world, I would suggest that you have a momentum on a retreat. You have a momentum of the reflective mind. You have a momentum of sitting practice, keeping precepts, non-distraction. There's a lot of very, very good qualities which have been cultivated here. And you could, it would be good to somehow keep that momentum going. But if you attach to the stillness that might exist in consciousness now, to that stillness, to the refinement of mind, then you'll get in trouble. Because the stillness will be impacted by busyness now. You know, people will be moving at, you'll actually have to drive a car now, right? And learn, and maybe move more quickly, and cook your own food. And so life will get busy, so that affects your mind in a different way, and it's more coarse. It's not refined. But the practice of awareness is to know coarseness and refinement rather than to attach to refinement. And that's one of the errors I think people make. They think that refinement is the goal of meditation. So then they get the mind very, very refined. I was speaking to a friend and he said he found that he would do a practice which would get him very, very, very refined, very, very refined, and then the slightest noise would really make him angry. And he realized, no, that's attachment to refinement, that's not the practice. And that's a mistake we make. But notice, awareness knows refinement. Awareness knows coarseness. So if you're, like now, because I've been talking with everyone, my mind's busy with the echoes of that talking. Why not? It's just the way it is. It's different. And if I sit for a few hours, then it'll be, you know, so that's just the way it is. But if I attach to some kind of a mind which just never has any talking in it, then it wouldn't be life. I have echoes in my mind. It's natural. But awareness knows that. Oh, it's just this is the result of that. With this, there is that. Ajahn Sumedho had a nice line he was sharing with me when I was in Thailand. He said he was in a cave somewhere or in a room. It was so dark you couldn't see your hand. And it came to him, he said, that which knows darkness is light. I like that. That which knows darkness is light. Huh? So that which knows refinement, or that which knows coarseness, that's the liberating quality of consciousness. The liberating possibility. But the qualities like refinement and coarseness, they're just dependent on other things. So what can we take away from here? Well, we can't take the experience, but we can take the kind of accumulation of virtue that we have been involved in. We can sustain like more capacity to like one of the suggestions I made early on is like just learn to listen, stop. Go to no thought. Huh? Remember, go to no thought. You know that kind of suggestion? You can do that. Hopefully in doing it. Just listen, stop. No thought. And like training in that simple suggestion. You're in Wellington and you're waiting for the light to change and your mind's thinking about tomorrow, just stop. Red light, no thought. You kind of break up the patterns and obsessions of mind. So that's just like day-to-day awakening, moment by moment awakening. That's something that we could make stronger. Precepts, just like really, really working on like right speech and all the other things. I mean, the precepts seem so obvious to me. Okay. Why would you kill anyone, right? But just like, let's just like right speech now, because we have a lot of awareness now. As we communicate through emails or face-to-face, like, can I be one who speaks in ways of concord? Who brings gladness? you know, words are so, and I've spoken about this like 3 or 4 times, I hope I'm not sounding like a preacher here. But it just does seem to me to be important, because words are such, they can be such beautiful things. Like Ansel Adams, he had this phrase, I thought of it today, when I saw the clouds up the valley, it's beautiful lighting in the southern hemisphere here, when you get the southerly wind, and these lovely fluffy clouds. And I had that line came to me, the benediction of light, the blessing of light. And what beautiful language. Language can do that, it can uplift you, poetry. And then someone calls me a turkey. Right? Oh, thanks. When we first came here, we're walking down, someone rolls the window open, get a job! That's language, you know. Kind of. And it has a different effect. So language is powerful. Sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you? Not true. Yeah, not true at all. You get it, you know, we affect each other. So you consider, one of the things I think we all try to consider, that if someone has an attitude toward me or uses language toward me which I find hurtful, can I take that and say, all beings would feel this hurt if I did that to them? Can I turn it around to no, I'm not going to go that way? That would be a lovely use of that. Or do I just say, you know, try to bash them or something like that? So when you feel hurt by someone with language which is unskillful, or you get an email, you kind of just feel that and say, I'm not going to do that to others. I don't want to go there. Or then when you feel language which is really uplifting and encouraging and beautiful, and you feel, oh, that feels nice. You know, I think I'll go that route. You can't do it all the time. You know, you lose the plot. That's all right, but you try. And then, that's the source of gladness. You begin to see that's the source of gladness, that's the sort of source of beauty. And this isn't sentimental. You know, it might sound sentimental, but you realize how hard it is to do, isn't it? Really hard to do. But this is where all of the beautiful qualities of consciousness begin to manifest. Devotion, gratitude, this intention not to harm other beings through action and speech. So that's something I think we can carry forward. I think also like a really good sitting practice, if you can get that going. Now you've got some momentum. And it seems urban societies, so in Canada probably, it's very hard for people to stop. You know, it's just everyone seems to have so much to do. And they, you know, the joke I like to tell is like you do the retreat and then you feel inspired. You say, yeah, I'm going to sit an hour a day. And then in a second week it's 45 minutes. Third week, it's a half an hour. 2 months later, you wave to the Buddha as you go to work. That's it. So that kind of sustaining of a practice, and that's a challenge. And the thing is, if one really loves this whole way of developing one's life, then if you don't really honor it, you tend to lose self-respect, don't you? And you kind of think, I could do more. So that determination to stay with the practice, not just out of a sense of duty, because I was talking with some folk and, you know, they said meditation is like, I got to do the dishes and I got to do my meditation and I got to do my emails. It becomes like just another thing on the checklist. But to see it as a craft, as a beautiful place you can return to, the place of ease, the place of stopping, then it has a kind of more positive quality. But anyway, we have this kind of momentum of regular sitting, so how could you maybe introduce that and stay with it as a kind of determination? So one of the paramitas that we talk about is the paramita of, it's called adhitana, determination, where you make a intention and then you try to. It's kind of like a vow, I suppose. Quite often you do it to someone you really respect, like maybe a monk, and you go and you say, Bhante, I'm gonna sit half hour every morning before work. And you do it very vocally, very publicly kind of thing, rather than just say it to yourself, well, I might sit half an hour. It sounds a fair idea. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But you really, you know, you really set your mind. I'm gonna do this. And then that setting of the mind helps you, first of all, to do it, and then helps you to look at when you're not doing it. And so you reaffirm that. And that's developing the paramita of determination. And all these things add up. They add up to a spiritual life rather than just a spiritual experience. Spiritual lifestyle, a lifestyle, a spiritual way of being is a kind of really full-on commitment. But it's not selfish. It's a mode of understanding yourself so that you can act more compassionately, so that there is more generosity. And if you think about it, the amount of rubbish we've all liberated quite a bit of rubbish, I'm sure, has given us much more freedom. You know, and if I think about my teenage years, just the confusion of trying to figure out who I am, I was just self-obsessed. Naturally so, I had to be, you know, trying to figure out who I am as a human being, but not terribly sensitive. And then I got into the monastery, and then I remember the second year in the monastery, I began, you know, through meditation, through reflection, through Ajahn Chah's presence and so on, I began to have feelings of gratitude to my parents. And not that I didn't, you know, it just never occurred to me. You know, they just fed me, you know, kind of thing. Typical selfish teenager. And then I just felt, oh gosh, I haven't done anything for them. Oh dear. So I went to Ajahn Chah with this kind of naive feeling, oh, maybe I should disrobe and go back to Canada. And they didn't need me, they're okay. And he said, now listen, did you ever feel this before? I said, no, not really. He says, well, that the meditation's working. Just hang in for a few years, and then when your parents need you, you'll be available. And he was right. He was right. But it's interesting to see from the meditative life these lovely qualities beginning to come forth, kind of qualities of wanting to serve and compassion. And these are the good results of the spiritual life, and they're the real source of happiness. So the end game tomorrow, if you're wondering how we're going to finish it off, we're not going to party. So we'll come together at 9 o'clock, maybe do a bit of sitting, and then for those who, I'll probably say something to conclude the retreat, and then for those who want, you can take the 5 precepts, and then we'll do some blessing chants. Very simple. And so we'll probably finish by 10 or so. Okay, leave that for tonight.